Okay, we're ready. So today we're going to do, it's a slight variation from what I said, because the two, Mary Jo and Ravi, asked to take next week, so you're splitting next week. So what we're doing today is the post-Hegelian philosophy of religion and reality myth symbol. Okay? All right, so, I didn't pass out the notes. I wonder if everybody's looking at this pile. 1, 2, 3, down there, and 2 over here, is that from the front?
It should be this way, okay.
Okay. So, the post-Hegelian philosophy of religion, which is from the third collection. I have a hypothesis that it disagrees with Fred Crowe's reading of the paper Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon. But it simply is a hypothesis, and I haven't really tested it yet. I think that paper, Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon, was written for this conference in Winnipeg in 1980, and that Lonergan substituted, for some reason, post-Hegelian philosophy of religion, rewrote the material in this form. I think that the subject matter is so similar in the two lectures that this is one of the main reasons that I'm hypothesizing that. You know, remember, with the philosophy and the religious phenomenon, we discovered that after Lonergan's death, and we had no idea what he wrote it for, and we tried to date it, and definitely what Fred said is true, that it is definitely in the late 70s or 1980. It's in that time period. Now, he hypothesized that he had written it for a conference in 1978 in Ottawa, and then instead reread his paper 3 years earlier, Prolegomena to the Future of, to the Study of the Emerging Religious Consciousness of Our Time. Now, that's a possible hypothesis, but I think we're going to see some evidence as we go through this that it can be argued that perhaps Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon was written for this meeting in 1980, and then for some reason he rewrote it as opposed to getting in Philosophy of Religion. So anyway, with that in mind, let's start. So Lonergan wrote this paper clearly and delivered it at a conference in 1980 in Winnipeg, the 14th Congress of the International Association for the History of Religion. He's attempting to offer to the members of the association a philosophy of religion, and he makes it clear that that's what he was asked to do. Well, that's very similar to what he says at the beginning of Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon, that I was asked to state what, from a philosophical standpoint, is the validity of religion. So it's very similar question that he's addressing, and he was asked to address. So evidence... some evidence that could be used to support my hypothesis. The theme of philosophy of religion comes up again, and it's stated that what a philosophy of religion is stated very similarly to the way in which he stated it in Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon, causing me to wonder what the connection is between these two papers, and then I put forth this hypothesis. All right, so getting into the meat of the article. Post-Hegelian, what he means is a philosophy of religion. Hegel proposed a philosophy of religion, but it was worked out a priori as the necessary implications of his dialectical logic. And so just as everything else was worked out, history and art and the meaning of philosophy itself and so on. Now, like the German historical school, which reacted against Hegel's philosophy of history, Hegel's philosophy of history was a priori drawn from his logical system. And the German historical school said, no, the point of history is to say, be as eigentlich gewesen, how it actually happened. Concrete historical facts. That's what history is all about, the study of history. How it actually happened, what actually happened, and how it actually happened. Who, under what circumstances, did what, why? That's what history studies. And then the history of religion school, it's the same thing with regard to religion. So they also reacted against Hegel's a priori understanding of religion, and they said if you want to understand what religion is, you have to study the religions in their concrete activity. So like those two, Lonergan withdraws entirely from the necessity that Hegel imposed on religion, that religion necessarily emerges at such and such a time under such and such circumstances and will necessarily be overcome by philosophy, which will sublate religion in an aufhebung into some higher synthesis and so on. But Lonergan says, I still want to retain something of Hegel, namely his comprehensiveness. And I think that I can do that by shifting my attention from Hegel's dialectical logic to a philosophic account of empirical method. So he says, first of all, this will be much more familiar to most people than Hegel's dialectic. And it will be particularly familiar to scientists because it names what scientists do. They isolate the data, they hypothesize an understanding of the data, they verify, check their hypothesis, and if it's not falsified, then there's evidence for the hypothesis. Moreover, he finds the procedure justified as well by Collingwood's notion of how to study history. So Collingwood's notion, so just not only is it justified because scientists proceed this way, but also historians proceed by the use of concrete empirical method. For Collingwood, the philosophy of history is the methodological component present in the consciousness that a scientific historian has of his or her own performance. So, says Lonergan, for this can be extended, this notion of the philosophy of. So the philosophy of science would be the consciousness of the proper method of the subject in the consciousness of every scientist. There is a conscious awareness of what is the proper thing to do at a certain point in scientific investigation. That's not always explicitly articulated correctly, but it's still there. And that's why Einstein said, if you want to know the philosophy of science, watch what they do. Don't pay attention to what they say they're doing, because they can get that screwed up. Well, watch what they're actually doing. They have this awareness of what is the thing to do at this particular moment. And that, the articulation, the correct articulation of that methodological component, is for Collingwood the philosophy of science, or for Collingwood that's the philosophy of history. That component in the consciousness of the historian, if that could be articulated, which is what Collingwood tried to do in his book, The Idea of History, which Lonergan mostly approves of. Well, thinks it's brilliant in most of its parts. He's only got one disagreement with it. But what Collingwood was attempting to do was to articulate what that tacit self-awareness is as the historian proceeds to find out, discover what was actually going forward at a particular time in history at a particular place. So the philosophy of history would be the methodological component in the performance of the historian. The philosophy of science would be the methodological component in the performance of the scientist. The philosophy of religion, then, would be the methodological component in the performance of the student of religion. So he says, in this fashion, we are led to recognizing as many philosophies of as there are distinct sciences with appropriately differentiated methods. Now, this is very similar to the point that he made about what the philosophy of religion is in the philosophy in the religious phenomena. It's the methodological component in religious studies. Moreover, all of these philosophies of, philosophy of science, philosophy of history, philosophy of religion, will share a common dynamism that grounds the real unity and common philosophy of scientists and as well enables them to appeal to people of common sense. So the first part, he says the first part, but it's actually part one and two of the paper, treat these common dynamics as discernible, first of all, in methods generally, that's part one, and then the different dynamics in distinct fields, part two. And then the final part of the paper will deal with the divergence and the possible unity of results that arise when different methods are employed in the same field as in religious studies. So first of all, then, method as general dynamics, part one. We're quite familiar with a lot of this, so we can certainly discuss it as much as possible. But as you notice, these notes are short because a lot of this is repetition, and I telescoped a lot into the notes, but that doesn't mean we can't unpack it more if need be. So the first section treats the common dynamics discernible in methods in general. That should be in general, not generally, in general. The key to method is the relation between questioning and answering. The ancient question that Plato raised in, I think it was the Meno, but I'm not sure, but how is it that when we ask a question, we don't know the answer, but when we get to the answer, we know we've got it? What is that? What is that strange ability that we have to recognize when we've answered our question? And that, for Lonergan, is the core of method. You ask a question because you don't know what the answer is, but when you get to the answer, you say, that's it. Well, what enables us to do that? That ongoing dynamism in questioning and answering is the key to method. The questioner, while he or she does not know the answer, at least intends it. So method will be a study of that intention, of that intentionality. Moreover, the question itself sets a standard, and that standard must be met. And if it's not met, then you say, well, yeah, but... And so you evince that you're not satisfied with the answer. The standard leads to the rejection of insufficient answers. And insufficient answers need not be useless, because they might be steps along the way. They might lead the questioner to pin down more accurately the precise issue that he or she wished to raise. Further, such clarification may bring to light the existence of intermediate questions. Maybe we've got to answer this first before we get to that, and so on, that have to be resolved before the initially intended question can be met. So that's the key to method, is understanding the questions that we raise. This ongoing process can be the common concern, not just of an individual, but of associations of scientists or associations of scholars, where questions raised anywhere can be known elsewhere. That used to be through journals. Now, today, it's on the Internet. You can go onto the Internet and find out who's saying what in Catholic theology. There's a whole thing now, the European Catholic Theology Association, that somehow they got my name and they send me their newsletter. So I can find out what's going on over there just by plugging in. They can give rise to an array, so the questions raised anywhere can be known elsewhere. They can give rise to an array of insufficient answers that successively beg for a clarification of the issue or issues. And the clarifications will hasten as far as possible at the time the new answers, which initial questions may have done more to intimate than to formulate. So that's a complicated way of saying that the more the questions get out into the open, the better chance you've got of getting your answer, because the clarifications will come with answering individual questions, and those clarifications will move you more closely, more quickly to the answer that you wanted when you started out. So there's the general relationship between questions and answers. We would ask questions because we don't know. The asking is intending an answer, and we can take stabs at answers which may be partial, but we know they're partial. We know that not everything that was included in our question is resolved by one particular answer, but it may be part of the answer, or it may be a stepping stone to the answer. But when we get to the answer, somehow we know that that question's been answered. So from this relation of questioning and answering, he goes on to add the three types of questions. There are questions for intelligence. What is it? Why does this happen? How often does this happen? Questions for understanding, for the second level of consciousness. Questions that cannot be answered yes or no. You don't answer yes to a question, what is it? What is that? Yes, that doesn't make any sense. What is it? You've got to have some kind of conceptual content to that. But then there's the question for reflection. Is that true? And those questions can be answered yes or no. Questions for reflection. So questions for understanding, questions for reflection, and then finally questions for deliberation. What are we to do about it? So each kind of question has its own immanent objective and criterion, and the objectives stand in an ascending order, is using the spatial metaphor again, with each completing what its predecessor had attained. So judgment completes what is attained, in understanding, and decision, if it's an existential issue, completes the knowledge reached in judgment. With this, we're already familiar, and we don't need to repeat it, the three kinds of questions where the objectives stand in ascending order. We don't need to repeat it, but I just did anyway. But again, there's the mention of what elsewhere has been called. Notice again, the fourth time in these writings, what in one place was the passionateness of being, in another place is the tidal movement, in another place is undifferentiated eros, same thing. This triad of questions and answers are only part of the ascensional structure of our intentional activity. Its hidden root is the unconscious, again, coming out of the neural and into consciousness. And so, again, the same point that was made in the paper on the philosophy and the religious phenomenon. In this paper, he appeals or refers to Walter Kahn's work relating Piaget, Erickson, and Kohlberg in terms of self-transcendence. But all of those, all three of them, people who were aware of this prior dimension the release into consciousness from the unconscious and so on. And this allows Lonergan, again, remember what he did in Philosophy and the Religious Phenomenon, this allows him to speak of the successive degrees of self-transcendence, starting with the dream, and then waking experience, and then understanding, and then judgment, and then decision, and then implicitly, more than implicitly, a topmost level of love. So here we have another metaphor besides the spatial metaphor. Degrees. Degrees rather than levels. And notice that again here, as in philosophy and the religious phenomenon, there are at least implicitly six. As he mentioned them in philosophy and the religious phenomenon, we're around page 207 in the third collection. Page 208 in the third collection. The main large paragraph there. Before closing this first part of my first section, I feel I should indicate roughly, not yet the stages, but perhaps the successive degrees of self-transcendence. The first is the emergence of consciousness in the fragmentary form of the dream, where human substance yields place to the human subject. The second, it's a 208, around 208. The second is waking, when our senses and feelings come to life, where our memories recall pleasures and our imaginations anticipate fears, but our vitality envisages courses of action, so experience. The third is inquiry, which enables us to move out of the mere habitat of an animal and into our human world of relatives, friends, acquaintances, associates, projects, accomplishments, ambitions, fears. The fourth is the discovery of a truth, judgment, which is not the idle repetition of a good look, but the grasp in a manifold of data of the sufficiency of the evidence for our affirmation or negation. The fifth is the successive negotiation of the stages of morality and or identity, so that whole level of decision, till we reach the point where we discover that it is up to ourselves to decide for ourselves what we are to make of ourselves. Where we decisively meet the challenge of that discovery, where we set ourselves apart from the drifters. For drifters have not yet found themselves. They have not yet found their own deed, and so are content to do what everyone else is doing. They have not yet found a will of their own, and so they're content to choose what everyone else is choosing. They have not yet developed minds of their own, and so they're content to think and say what everyone else is thinking and saying. and everyone else, it happens, can be doing and choosing and thinking and saying what others are doing and choosing and thinking and saying. And then, implicitly, there's a sixth level, because the next paragraph, but this fifth stage in self-transcendence becomes a successful way of life only when we really are pulled out of ourselves, as, for example, when we fall in love. Whether our love be the domestic love that unites husband and wife and children, or the love of our fellow men and women, whose well-being we promote and defend, or the love of God above all, whom we love our neighbor as ourselves. So that's what in philosophy and the religious phenomena he was speaking of as a sixth level. So, again, the close relationship between the two papers leads me to wonder if they weren't written right around the same time and perhaps for the same general meeting or convention. Anything up to that point to discuss? Okay.
The level that's the unconscious, do you just call that the unconscious?
Yeah, that would not be a level of consciousness.
Right.
So it would be prior to consciousness. Yeah. The first, we become conscious first in our dreams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the earliest level.
Yeah.
Okay, Method as General Dynamics, Part 2. In Part 2, he's applying, or at least talking about, how these dynamics, these levels, these degrees of self-transcendence, can be differentiated in different methods, in different sciences, in different pursuits. So, in the first part, he was talking generally about the relationship between questions and answers. But we don't just ask questions, we ask quite specific questions. And we ask different questions in theology from the ones that we ask in history, from the ones that we ask in physics. So to know what precisely what questions are to be asked, one has to turn from the core of methods generally, which will be this experiencing, understanding, judging, decision in this essential structure, to the differentiation of that core. But that's a tall order. And here all he does is distinguish the mathematics, the modern natural sciences, and the human sciences. So there are mathematics and the modern natural sciences. And he says a little bit about each of those. But he's mainly concerned about the human sciences and about making this point, that the success of the natural sciences does not transfer in any thoroughgoing fashion to human studies. They're about something different. And one of the reasons for that, in different places he'll talk about different reasons for that. One of them is that the natural sciences are in close dependence on mathematics. And the development of modern mathematics has provided an enormous liberation to physicists from mechanist determinism, because there's all kinds of things that you can do in mathematics as you're constructing these different mathematical possibilities. But then you might find that some of them are actually relevant to data experienced data. In that case, you're into physics. And some of these models that mathematicians create are not determinist or mechanist at all. And what if those are relevant to the data? Then mechanist determinism is seriously challenged at that point. So it's one of the challenges to mechanist determinism came out of the very development of mathematics, when it was discovered that some mathematics, free constructions, mathematical constructions, were actually relevant to understanding experienced data. But Lonergan is claiming that it's not going to be mathematics that will liberate the human studies. It will be philosophy. Philosophy would provide a parallel liberation to human studies, but not any philosophy. Basically saying not any philosophy, mine, that's what we'll do. A critical philosophy that acknowledges that the events that come together to constitute human knowing are the givenness of the data, a cumulative series of insights into the data, a probable judgment on the adequacy of the insights. Our world is a world mediated by meaning and motivated by value. And so it is a world that, while it includes mathematics, can't be mastered by mathematics. It has to be mastered by an understanding of meaning and an understanding of value. So it's the differentiation of the functions of meaning, that's what he goes into next, distinguishing the four basic functions of meaning. Meaning is cognitive, it's efficient, it's constitutive, it's communicative. Now, I really telescope several pages here because he practically is quoting himself verbatim from Ethics and Theology, and I just thought that you would have been familiar with that already. So he's repeating here much of what's in Method and Theology about the cognitive, efficient, constitutive, and communicative functions of meaning, and the way in which the conjunction of constitutive and communicative functions of meaning yields the notions of community, existens, the existential subject, and history. But he does fill out in a way here that is not present in Method and Theology, the way his analysis of history, drawing on Toynbee's analysis of creative minorities and the way in which they can go wrong. Now, I can repeat some of that. For Toynbee, the developments in history take place because of creative minorities. It's creative minorities that get the new ideas. And at first, the views of the creative minority are regarded as crazy. Then they're regarded as true, but oh, so obvious. Boring. And then finally, as he said at the end of one of the other papers, they're seen to be so important that the people who once reviled them now claim that they developed them. Very cynical view of this. But it is, for Toynbee, it is basically creative minorities who provide the development in all fields, whether it be academic fields or artistic fields or socio-political fields. It's creative minorities. There's a great article in the Now magazine that just came out today on the Christian peacemakers teams and the political significance of what they're doing. And I wrote a letter. I got so excited by it, I wrote a letter to the editor and said, thanks, this is just great. The potential political meaning of this kind of peacemaking, the changes that could come if we grasped it and got a hold of it. Anyway, creative minorities initiating changes in the world. Okay. But what can often happen is that down the line, the creative minorities get used to power once their ideas are taken up. And this is another one of Toynbee's points. And they become corrupt from within, and then there's decline, and then you've got to have another creative minority that comes along to offset the corruption and so on. So he fills that out in some detail in there. Anyway, that's all I wrote on part two, but there may be other things that you want to take.
Is that very central to him, or it's just a theory at that time that talked about the movement of history, and he agreed at that moment with that?
You mean Lonergan himself?
Yes.
Or Toynbee? I think Lonergan picked that up from Toynbee, and he repeats it. What? His attitude on Toynbee changed over the years. When he first read Toynbee, it was in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And he thought at that point that Toynbee was actually doing history. But he came to see later, no, he's not doing history. What he's doing is providing ideal types for the study of history. So he's providing models. He's providing things that it may be useful to have around when you're trying to understand what actually happened. So the creative minority is a model that it might be useful to have when you're trying to understand how a change has taken place, whether it be a change in a science or, Kuhn's scientific revolutions, it's creative minorities. And sometimes it could be a minority of one. But it's creative minorities that bring about the changes. And at first they are ridiculed. Or because people are threatened by what's going to have to happen. But eventually, in the natural sciences, they will catch on. If they're valid, they will catch on fairly quickly because they explain more of the data that the natural sciences are studying than did the previous theory. So that's the criterion. Now, in the human sciences, it's different because the idea can explain more, it can be quite useful, but it can be so demanding on changes that we might have to make in our own living that perhaps, they're not going to be picked up as quickly. But anyway, what Lonergan came to see is that all of these ideas in Toynbee, withdrawal and return, he uses the example of Marx withdrawing into the British Museum, where everybody thought he was an old man with a long white beard, was coming into the British Museum every day and sitting there reading these books and writing little notes, you know, withdrawal, but for the sake of a massive return and influence on the world. And creative minorities and that sort of thing. These are models that it's useful to have when you're studying the concrete realities. But it's not necessarily the case that it always happens this way, but very frequently it does. And, you know, in art, the Impressionists and the different schools of different developments in music and so on are the work of creative minorities.
In theology and the dialectics of history, in the section you are talking of dialectics of a community, talking of the infrastructure and the superstructure,
right.
You appear to have, well, my own reading of it, it appears to me you are indirectly making use of this creative minority.
Making use of?
This idea of a creative minority.
Right.
In the sense of having a group of people who will be able to provide a conducive atmosphere that will bring about good of order.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I mean, that's my understanding, actually, of Cosmopolis mm-hmm. in Lonergan.
Yeah.
You know, it's a mentality affecting a group of people,
yeah.
And the group is necessarily, at least at the beginning, going to be a minority.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't stretch that far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our thinking is extremely pragmatic.
Yeah.
General bias.
Mm-hmm.
Cosmopolis is a mentality that is ready to persuade people beyond general bias,
mm-hmm.
and providing the atmosphere where the questions can be faced. Mm-hmm. And so, and of course, you know, I mean, this is what education should be doing, but in a lot of instances, is not. But yeah, that's, you're right. I don't use the term.
No, yeah, you do not use the term.
And world cultural humanity also for me is creative. Mm-hmm. It start out as a creative minority. And then I think what we have to see is that there are many different forces coming together on this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, I think that I would see that the kind of intellectual basis that is given in Lonergan's understanding of the constants in human consciousness would be a very good intellectual foundation for what I'm calling world cultural humanity,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately may prove to be the integrating thing for this emerging reality. But there will be a lot of other contributions to it, and in particular in different areas. And I think that nonviolent approach to the world's problems. We can't afford. I mean, that's just even pragmatically, we can't afford anything but a nonviolent approach.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think. Anyway, okay. So, there was something else that I was thinking of there. I lost it. It'll come back. All right, so the third part of the paper, he deals with philosophy of religion. So taking this, what he's been saying then, this core, and applying it to this core dynamic of method, applying it to religion. Philosophy of means method of. So what is the respective relevance of diverse methods to the study of religions? Well, he says, now this is a very interesting statement, and I haven't seen it put quite this way before, but it ties back to the papers that Jeff reported on religious studies and theology, and to a couple of things that we've seen since then. If you limit yourself to exploring the many religious traditions and reconstructing the history of the overt data on our religious living, you're really limiting yourself to the methods of the natural sciences. Experiencing, understanding, judging, but not getting into the whole area of involvement, existential involvement in the religions. So so a lot of schools of religious studies would really be following the methods of the natural sciences in studying the religions And as Wilfred Cantwell Smith pointed out in his major lecture, which Lonergan relies on so often, that's okay, it's valuable, but there's this whole thing of religious commitment, religious involvement. What's that all about? Religious engagement. What makes religion come alive? What has happened when religion withers and dies? So what is wanting in the exclusive use of the methods of the natural sciences is an account of the meaningfulness of religious tradition, belief, imperatives, rituals. The meaningfulness that can demand the totality of a person's response. And religion, as we know, can demand that. And what is that? What is that? What is that meaningfulness? How is it reached? How is it investigated? The methods of the natural sciences can't answer that. There has to be some entrance into the data of consciousness. There has to be some understanding of the meaningfulness of striving to become self-transcendent, the meaningfulness of making progress on the way. There has to be an appeal to the data of consciousness, what self-transcendence is. So self, and that striving to become self-transcendent, well, it begins in socialization, acculturation, education. It culminates in religious commitment. And so then he goes into a lot of the stuff that he said in other places as well. Friedrich Heiler, who in that article that Lonergan relies on quite frequently, disengaged seven characteristics that can be found in all the at least major religions of the world. And they're all listed in there. We can go back and look at them if you wish. But then he moves on from Heiler, and he says it's especially enlightening to study the ascetics and the mystics of the various traditions, as both Heiler and Panikkar do. For Lonergan, these are the ones who disclose religious conversion as a total commitment to religious self-transcendence. But there are materialist, immanentist, and critical realist interpretations of these matters. For the materialist, our notion of God is a projection on the sky of idealized human qualities. But like as in Feuerbach, for instance. But our seeking, which is the origin of our self-transcendence, is not just a quality, it's potentiality, it's finality. It scorns, so it's dialectical. It scorns any arbitrary brushing aside, burying of questions. Something dialectical about it. The methods of natural science don't get into dialectic. There's nothing dialectical about atoms and proteins and so on. Dialectic is the consciousness. It's something that occurs in consciousness, that kind of conflict. And even the image of projection, Lonergan says, well, it's like a movie projector or a magic lantern that projects a shadow on a wall. But movie projectors and lanterns don't experience. And they don't inquire intelligently. They don't judge on the basis of sufficient reason. They don't decide freely and responsibly. So it may be that speaking of a projection is a naive realist image, projection, automatic projection. Okay. Not that there aren't such things. There are projections in interpersonal relations. I think those have been quite clearly spelled out by some psychologists, people who project their mothers or their fathers or whatever onto other people and then treat them in the same way. And they don't realize that that's what they're doing. But that's the thing about projection. See, is that you don't realize that you're doing it. And what Lonergan is calling attention to is that in addition to that, we inquire intelligently, we judge reasonably, we decide responsibly. And that's more than these automatic projections. So projections can be understood. And they can be understood correctly. And something can be done about them, which is what happens in some psychotherapeutic processes is that, oh my God, I've been treating so-and-so as if you were my father. I didn't know I was doing that. Well, that's an insight. And then you can do something about it. And that's more than a lantern or a movie projector is able to do. They can just project, but we can understand our projections and correct them. So that's what he does with the materialist objection with regard to religious commitment. The immanentist is a very interesting thing here on Vogelin, and it's the first time that he's said it, and he doesn't say it explicitly, but I'm saying to myself, why did he bring Vogelin in here? I think that Vogelin's effort to downplay the importance of doctrine, and so of making true statements, for Lonergan is an immanentist position with regard to the significance of religious value. Lonergan agrees wholeheartedly with everything that Vogelin says, except Vogelin's statement that, you know, don't try to make truth claims about this. And as a Catholic, of course, he has to. If he's going to remain a Catholic, he has to oppose that repudiation of all doctrine. So, but I think he finds, first of all, that Vogelin does meet the needs of a philosophy of religion, because he's very aware of what is going on with distinguishing the cosmological myth and the more differentiated forms that emerge in philosophy, prophecy, and the gospel, and so on. Well, that's all being aware of the methodological component in your study of religion. Something's happening, something's different as you move from the study of the myths of Egypt to the book of Exodus and so on. Some liberation from the cosmological myth taking place there. But Lonergan seems to be thinking, I think, he doesn't say it quite explicitly, that if we agree with Vogelin's repudiation of all doctrine, we choose an immanentist interpretation. So for Vogelin, you follow the symbolization where it leads you. And all of that's fine. And that's what we do. But there comes a point where you have to, where you're forced to say, is it true or not? Is it a true story? Or is it just a story? And Lonergan says, well, we can distinguish two forms of doctrinization. There can be a doctrinization that will abolish the experience of living in the truth. And Lonergan would repudiate that every bit as much as Vogelin would. If it's a doctrinization that's cut off from the experience of living in the truth, then it's arbitrary. But it could also be a doctrinization that emerges by asking the question, is this symbol that I've been following, or this set of symbols, or this story, does it say something true about human existence, about God? And if so, what? What is it saying? That's the critical realist interpretation of religious symbols. And at this point, it's interesting how Lonergan in these late writings is referring to some of his students, and you know, I know that he's done it with me, but he's done it in earlier in the paper with Walter Kahn, in an earlier paper with Fred Lawrence, and now with Giovanni Sala on Lonergan and Kant, and William Ryan from Spokane University, Gonzaga University in Spokane, on Lonergan and Husserl, both of whom distinguished Lonergan from the idealist position that could not, that didn't know the difference between understanding and judgment. And Sala's book on Lonergan and Kant, unfortunately, it went out of print with the University of Toronto Press, and I guess it didn't sell enough that they decided that they wanted to reprint it. But, you know, you want to know the difference between Lonergan and Kant, all you really have to do is read the first chapter. And it's so clearly laid out where the differences are between the two of them. But there are five chapters, and they're all brilliant studies of Lonergan. And then Ryan's dissertation on Lonergan and Husserl, where the element of judgment emerges in Lonergan in a way that is just not found in Kant or Husserl, and that's what he's trying to get at here as being important. Doctrine is judgment. And there are judgments. There are moments where we're called to make judgments, and we have to beware that our judgments don't become doctrinaire, cut off from the experience, imposed upon people. But there's another kind of judgment that is the one that, you know, I believe in God the Father Almighty, but the judgment of the creed, if it's coming out of articulate religious experience, is not at all a doctrinaire judgment. But it is the expression of doctrine. Is that clear?
My question is on self-transcendence. Self-transcendence, if I understand Lonergan in insight, is a dialectics between a limitation and a transcendence itself.
Okay, this is interesting. Okay, go on.
Okay.
Do you have more?
Yeah.
More that
you want to say? So, but it's not so easy for me to distinguish self-transcendence and self-actualization, whether one depends on grace and the other one does not depend on grace. The difference between self-transcendence and self-actualization.
The self-actualizing person is the person who is transcending himself or herself to meaning, to truth, to value. Self-transcending activity does actualize the self in a way that where the self is taking the self into account. But particularly, self-actualization is the fruit of the realization that it is up to you to decide for yourself what you are to make of yourself, and then doing that. So self-actualization flows from that existential moment where you move away from being the drifter to the person who has a mind of his or her own a task of his or her own to discover what your task is. You know, it's a big thing, but that's what retreats are all about. They really are all about discovering what your task is. Well, not all retreats. Some retreats could be simply healing of injuries or whatever. But the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, the full spiritual exercises, are discovering what your task is under God and under God's grace. Now, it doesn't occur without God's grace, self-actualization. Nor does consistent self-transcendence occur without grace. We can't do it consistently without grace. Moral impotence is that overpowering. This is Thomas's doctrine. It's also Lonergan's doctrine in insight. That moral impotence is so thoroughgoing that whether it be from psychic reasons or from intellectual and volitional reasons, that unless something from without, the way I analyzed it in Theology and the Dialectic of History is that a movement from below upwards is necessarily incomplete unless there is a movement from above downwards that enables the movement from below upwards to go all the way up. And to do that consistently, to live consistently in the self-transcendent posture. That's a lifetime's task. A lifetime's task. And we're always withdrawing from self-enclosure.
Is one right in saying that the dynamic structure of human knowing, as propounded by Lonergan, can lead somebody into self-transcendence?
Oh, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the asking questions is the beginning of self-transcendence. Mm-hmm. When you actually make a true judgment, you have transcended yourself. It's no longer what you feel, what you think. Mm-hmm. It's what is. Right. If it's true, it's what is. It's not what you'd like to be. It's what is. If there is such a thing as a true judgment, if there is, you know. But, Jeff.
I always wanted to ask you a question about Hegel, and now I have the opportunity. It's appropriate. I'd like to know, is Lonergan's wider view of history as positions being corrected and sublated into new ones. Professor Verton has articulated this pretty clearly in his Seven Families, if you've ever read them. You begin with Epicurus, you know, knowing is just sensing. Then Plato adds understanding. Aquinas adds judgment. Kant fine-tunes judgment. Hegel brings in some decision. Sartre keeps all that, but sublates it into the existential sort of stuff that we even see here. And then Lonergan sort of caps it all off. So is that notion of sublating previous positions but correcting them, did Lonergan get that from reading Hegel?
That's a good question. And does he not have a footnote and an insight about... It's not sublation, because he doesn't use the word sublation in insight. I'd like to check that in insight itself, but I think he has a footnote in insight where he says, let it not be thought that my attitude to Hegel is entirely negative. It is not. And from Hegel I have learned such and such, and I can't remember exactly what he learned.
Okay.
Hegel's sublation, his Aufhebung, is different from Lonergan's. There's a violence connected with Hegel's sublation. And if it's actualized politically, it could be a justification for political violence and for terror. And Lonergan's sublation does not repudiate anything of what it's sublating. It lifts it up. It moves it to a higher level. It enriches it. It doesn't destroy it. There's a book, a very, very interesting book by Alexander Kojève, Commentary on Hegel's Phenomenology, where in Kojève's interpretation, Hegel thought that by when he wrote, when he put the final period in the Phenomenology, history itself had come to an end. Not his book, history had come to an end, which is a rather inflated view of one's book, I would say. But Kojève's interpretation of Hegel was extremely influential in 20th century French philosophy. And there's a book called Modern French Philosophy by Alexandre Descombes, Descombes, that he quoted in Theology of the Dialectics of History, where he says if you want to understand post-structuralism and deconstruction and so on, to go back to Kojève, they all studied that book, and terror is the leitmotif of Kojève's interpretation of Hegel and of a lot of the early work in deconstruction. Not that they're promoting terrorism, it doesn't mean that at all, but rather that history is terror. It's an interesting interpretation. But that would be one thing where Lonergan, like when Lonergan says innocently, it's quite innocent, it sounds quite innocent when he says, I use the word sublation, not in the Hegelian sense, but in the sense that Karl Rahner uses it. It's a very deliberate saying that I'm not using sublation in the sense of doing violence to what is being sublated. What is being sublated is enriched, it is raised to a new level, it finds new significance and so on, but it is not destroyed. I think so that's something where his notion of sublation would be different from Hegel's. What else? See, for instance, for Hegel, philosophy will ultimately sublate religion. But when it does, there won't be any need for religion anymore. See? So you've got sublation overcomes. If it doesn't destroy, at least it overcomes. Whereas for Lonergan, anything that sublates just enriches what it submits. Doesn't overcome it. Doesn't eradicate it or destroy it.
Like thesis and antithesis are both wiped out towards the synthesis.
Well,
then.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how. I don't know how that's all connected, or even how all pervasive thesis, antithesis, synthesis is for understanding Hegel. I'm not sure of that, but I know that Aufhebung, which is the German word that translates as sublation, for Hegel has a negative moment to it, and it does not have it for Lanner, and it doesn't have it for Karl Rahner.
Yeah, recently I heard a conference about religious studies today, and it looks like the same issues that you were taking from Lonergan, and when he talks about immanentist, materialist, and critical realist. Mm-hmm. It looks like the discussion continues and the movements continue. At least what I saw is that the position of Feuerbach is getting a lot of strength, and the position of seeing religion as something that doesn't have any sense of transcendence and goodness. And I also saw that the materialist position and the inner and outer perspective is very much an issue right now in a discussion. Mm-hmm. If religion you see from inside or outside. Mm-hmm. And do you know how, like, the school of Lonergan is handling this? How are they discussing all this? How are they getting into the discussions with these ideas? Because I believe the religious studies keep on going, and they keep on discussing this, and they keep on talking about it.
What I haven't seen yet is any attempt to actually implement the program that he put forth in the Kingston lectures on theology and religious studies, and that he repeats in several other places after that about the possible integration mm-hmm. of theology and religious studies. There hasn't been the attempt yet to integrate this. I'm going to come back to it in a moment. But I want to say something else here about, with respect to the critiques like Feuerbach or so on. Lonergan approved very much what Ricoeur did with Freud. Ricoeur found a great deal of truth in Freud's criticisms of a lot of religion. Okay, a lot of it is infantile. It is. A lot of it is obsessional. And when Freud said religion is the universal obsessional neurosis of humankind, well, there's a lot of religion that is that. So what these critiques are helping us do is to differentiate, to disengage what is authentic in religion from what is unauthentic. And this is one of the major issues in the world today. If there's any issue that is before, in front of us, it's religion, you know, because religion could lead to the destruction of everything. And so to distinguish what is genuine religion, and what is obsession, what is neurosis, what is infantilism, what is projection, what is obscurantism, running away from the truth, running away from questions, not facing them. So Lonergan would welcome a lot. What he's saying with Feuerbach is it's not complete. It's obviously not complete. And the same with these other criticisms. Now, the other thing that I wanted to come back to, the non-event so far of the implementation of so much of this. You see, I just think until we get to the point where the Lonergan community is funded well enough to launch these kinds of efforts so that so what would this place be if the Lonergan Research Institute had an endowment of $10 million, for instance? The stuff that we could do along these lines. by bringing people in here, you know, for conferences on the implementation of the three papers on theology and religious studies, we could get a whole movement started, you know. But you can't do it if you're working on a shoestring. All you can do is put out the collected works and hope that some later generation has the wherewithal to get this stuff on the road and get it going. So there is that problem, and but behind the lack of the funding is a lack of conviction and commitment on the people who could do the funding or who could go for it, you know. The money's there, it's just that you can't persuade. But it's a universal problem. But we're not going to get the implementation on any kind of critical mass scale without the appropriate infrastructure to allow it to happen. But it is disappointing to me, you know, that so much of what he's said in these two books is so programmatic, but it hasn't yet been picked up on. But he was kind of content on that. He just said, you know, this is the way history is. He said, if there's anything in my economics, it'll take 150 years for people to find it. So, you know, and maybe that's true with some of the other stuff as well. Creative minority that sputters along for a while. You know, as long as it doesn't die, that's about all we can do. At least at my age, all I can do is do whatever I can to make sure it doesn't die. All right, let's take a break with that happy thought.
Fred Crowe's got an article, Objectivity versus Projection in Monitoring. Mm-hmm. I can make a copy and bring it in next week if you like.